G'day and welcome to Leaders of Men. I'm your host, Nick Warner. In a society that yearns for legitimate male role models, I speak to men that are forging the pathway to a healthy, integrated masculinity. It's an absolute honour to welcome my latest guest, Justin Patrick Pierce, international intimacy teacher and founder of the Yoga of Intimacy. Justin offers workshops and private trainings for men and women around the world to help them overcome challenges in relationship, master the embodiments of sexual polarity, and pursue a life of spiritual depth alongside their chosen partner. He and his wife, London Angel Winters, are co-teachers and co-authors of the Amazon best-selling book, The Awakened Woman's Guide to Everlasting Love. Now, I've spoken to a lot of men over the past couple of years since starting the Leaders of Men podcast, and without a shadow of a doubt, this is by far the deepest and most profound conversation I've had. You really get a sense of the transmission of groundedness, presence, and depth that comes across when Justin speaks. So I really hope you enjoy this as much as I did.
The function of leadership is to produce more leaders, not more followers. Leaders of Men.
G'day and welcome back to Leaders of Men. I'm super honored to have with us today Justin Patrick Pierce. How are you, Justin?
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Nick.
Nice to see you. Yeah. So, mate, I've known about you and your work for a number of years, and I was wondering if you could speak to how you got into it and what exactly it is that you do.
Back in 2009, I met my wife, London. We began dating then, and probably around early 2010, she dragged me to a intimacy workshop, which at first I had no interest in going to. I wasn't into that at all. Not something I really wanted to be part of. I ended up going, and it really blew my mind, what I experienced there. And I was asked to come back and come back and come back. And my wife, London, was kind of getting into the role of teaching assistant at that time. And then suddenly I just found I really had a knack for it. So suddenly I became a teaching assistant. And next thing you know, I was leading men and women in intimacy practices. And several years down the road, I'd say 3 to 5 years after that, is when I really started to take it much more seriously. And I made this a life path. So now spiritual intimacy is my life's work. It is my spiritual path. It's what I do. The core of my purpose is that practice, understanding it, living it. And then everything else that I do, my teachings just basically trickle out from the core of my practice. But for me, this is a spiritual path above all and anything.
Who was the teacher?
From my very first workshop was Michaela Ball.
Okay.
Yeah, and then she was very closely affiliated with David Data, so then David Data quickly had a very big influence on me then.
One of the things that I noticed, one of the first things I noticed about your work, is that you guys refer to alpha and omega rather than masculine and feminine.
Correct.
Can you speak to that for a little bit?
When we really look at what sexual yoga is trying to explain or teach, even through the archetypes of Shiva Shakti, what we're trying to fundamentally understand is this relationship between subject-object duality and the way it interacts. The masculine is represents the consciousness or that which cannot be observed, and the feminine is everything else, all that can be observed, light itself, light energy. So when we start to explore these ideas in terms of embodiments and how they play out in our relationships, how they play out through our sexuality, we start to begin playing with, okay, what happens if I rest as consciousness? And what happens if I identify with light and form and emotion and movement and animation? And as men and women, we are equally capable of doing either. We can identify with the emotions and the mental images and the movements that flow through us. And that gets expressed in five rhythms and ecstatic dance. You know, that's what all of that is about. And then there's resting as consciousness, the witness. That's what Vipassana is about, for example. So men and women are equally capable of embodying either, and our current culture is demonstrating that probably more than ever in history. So as we engage relationships today, we're going to meet a lot of women with a lot of alpha. We're going to meet a lot of men with a lot of omega. And if we don't understand how those dynamics are playing out in our relationships, we'll just feel ourselves frustrated, unable to trust, feeling unattracted to our partner, not knowing why. Men are like, oh, I got to be more masculine. Women are like, I got to be more feminine, not understanding there's something more profound to be learned there. That when we actually start to understand the dynamics at play, men don't have to be more masculine, women have to be more feminine. What we need to be is responsible for the way that we are showing up to each and every moment. And each and every moment, sometimes it serves to rest as consciousness. Sometimes it serves to slip into an emotive expression and let that move through your system and body in the form of ecstatic dance and liberation. And when we learn these energetics, that's when we really become artists in our lives and relationship. We're no longer confined to a dogmatic role, but instead liberated to really understand what we are as consciousness and life. And that, I mean, yes, we are men and women. That's true too. And we are not confined by that principle as we learn what it is that these practices are trying to teach us, that we are conscious light, and that conscious light is limitless and liberated, already free, already love. And then when we start to make love from that place, our love becomes divine, sacred.
Profound answer that also answered many of the other questions that I had going. What are some things that men do? I have a lot of men that I speak to, and it's very easy to recognize men that are perhaps more of the nice guy, and they step into a relationship and they're attracted to women that are more alpha or more into their masculine. And then they find it very difficult to switch that polarity just through a lack of understanding or some confusion. So what would you recommend for those men, a path moving forward?
So it sounds to me like the type of man you're describing is a man who has suppressed his own masculine qualities and therefore attracted or chose a partner who suppressed her own feminine qualities, and they met and matched there. And now he's having this awakening and he wants to bring more of his masculine qualities, but he didn't choose a partner necessarily who wants to do that same path with him. So yeah, why would he choose a partner who's equally hiding those parts of herself? Then he has this awakening. He suddenly expects her to embrace her feminine equally as him. Now, maybe she is ready for that, and maybe that's what they want to do, and they can grow together in that path. That's beautiful. That works. But if he's choosing a partner based on his own kinks and woundings and programming from the past, who also, his partner also has their own kinks and woundings for the reasons why they're showing up. They're perfectly polarized there in their wounds and in their, and those wounds are old. They started 3 years old, 4 years old. Those programs get built and reinforced inside of us through our whole lives. So by the time we're 20, 30 years old and we want to have this awakening and start living differently, it takes a lot of work. I mean, that's a huge endeavor to unwind those neurological systems and habits that are playing out unconsciously 24 hours a day. You have to become responsible of your language. You have to become responsible of your body language, what your body is doing moment to moment. You have to become responsible for how you're interacting with your lover. I mean, it's incredible what we do in this practice to wake up these parts of ourselves. So it's a huge deal. I would say this. If a man feels himself in that position, question he needs to honestly ask is his partner up for that too? does she feel inspired to let him be masculine? And she equally moves into her feminine expression. Is that something they want to do together? If so, that's a fit and they can grow. But if he's now going to have this awakening and then resent her for the way that she is, that she won't let him take the lead, that's on him. Like, he chose that relationship, that partner, and part of his biology is still choosing that relationship. So man's going to go through this awakening and he has a partner who's not on board for growing in that direction. It's his responsibility to get clear on what he really wants first and foremost, do the work he needs to do, and then choose a partner who's up for that dynamic that he wants to live inside of. But again, I say this as a broad stroke because every human being, every relationship is so different. So different. So what I just said is going to be totally appropriate for some men. And what I said is not the right thing for other men. So I just want to also phrase that because we're talking about very sensitive topics as we explore this. And I just want to make sure it's not a broad brush analysis here or prescription. Every human being is unique, but the points I bring up must be examined seriously if we're going to work with that in an intelligent way.
How do we raise men fully embodied in their healthy masculinity?
I think there's a presupposition behind that question that I don't know that I even subscribe to. And I came from a camp, you know, I came from like the superior man camp. Like I was trained in that and that's what I, you know, taught inside of. So I know that world intimately well. And I think it's a healthy world and it's a healthy exploration. What's a man? How does a man behave? What does a man look like? How does he show up in the world? How does he own his purpose? All of those questions, they're powerful questions and they're valid. But at a certain point, a man needs to accept himself as a man. Like, he doesn't have to do anything to be a man, just like a palm tree doesn't have to do anything to be a palm tree. A cloud doesn't have to do anything to be a cloud. It just is. It just is. A flower doesn't have to prove itself as a flower. It's just a flower. But we look at our body minds and we think failure. Like, I'm not what I am, or I don't deserve to be what I am, or I am less than what I am. And it fucks us up psychologically. And that wounding is what needs healing. It's not, here's a formula, go become a great man. I personally don't subscribe to that model because in it, there's an admission that you don't feel like a man. There's an admission that you are unhappy, that you're not enough, that you're a failure. And it's that very seed of a self-deprecating thought that is your suffering. And to liberate yourself from that suffering is to realize what you already are. What you already are, not that you have to prove yourself to be. We live in a world where everyone's trying to prove who they are. And it hurts. It's a world just riddled with suffering and egos battling. And then we have to face off with our own ego internally as we try and sleep at night. What kind of life is that? This practice has always been about liberating ourselves, loving ourselves at such a profound level. And you can't begin that process if our starting point is I'm not enough. I'm not the man I need to be. I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm a failure. We're starting off on the wrong foot. Now, some people are going to hear what I say there and they'll be like, but wait a minute. That feeling is what makes men great. And there's truth to that because some of the great, I've met many amazing men in my life. And some of the greatest men I've met are wounded. And they have this drive to try and prove something to the world or prove to their parents that their parents were wrong or prove they're worthy of this or that. And they create incredible things in our world as a result. True, absolutely true. But the reason this is a spiritual practice and not a form of self-development is because even if you pursue those goals in that vein, even if you acquire millions, billions of dollars, even if you create three incredible businesses, even if you, you know, change this part of the world, deep inside of you, you still feel like it's not enough. You feel like you're not enough. You're tormented internally. You're still afraid. There's still fear that drives you. You still look out into the world and feel abandoned, feel betrayed by it, feel at war with it. You're in this constant state of war. The whole point of spiritual practice is to liberate us from that delusion. So we start at the seed, the very root. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to accomplish. You are whole. You are as much of a man now as you will ever be, as you ever need to be. Let's start there. And now what? And now what? And that's where the healing of spiritual practice really begins, is when we finally wake up to the recognition that we don't have to do anything to be worthy of love. We don't have to do anything to be free either. This is where my journey has taken me in the very serious and disciplined practice of these arts and study of these arts, as we trace back to what are the origins, what's the real story trying to be told here. And this is what becomes profound and obvious to us as we walk this path.
No one will answer. So if you have a 12, 13-year-old son, how do you embody those teachings in him?
Just be present. It's moment to moment, take some time to just get down on a knee, look into his eyes, take a breath, pause, show him he doesn't have to be in a rush every single moment. Show him that he's loved. You don't even have to say it necessarily. Just the way you look, the way you breathe, you show that your body is relaxed, that you trust the present moment. If you can just embody that you trust the present moment, what greater gift could any human being give us? This is what the saints have all done. The saints have demonstrated bodily trust at the deepest level. That's what Ramana Maharshi does. He's just sitting there trusting absolutely the intensity of the present moment with such conviction that others are just entranced, like, oh, look, what is this guy know? What has he figured out? Because he sits there free. He sits there absolutely liberated. What is that liberation? It's trust. And this is the piece you brought up about women not trusting the masculine. Men don't trust the masculine either. Nobody trusts the masculine, because when we really investigate, okay, what is that? So if masculine is the consciousness, masculine is our condition as consciousness. Do I trust this? Literally, it's sitting here and just becoming still, observing that we are as consciousness. Do I trust this? Do I trust this body? Do I trust these organs to function? Do I trust my next breath to come in under my body? Do I trust that a bomb will not drop on my head? Or if it does, I can trust. Like, it becomes so existential, this concept of trust, and that's what these practices are trying to teach us. It's not merely your boyfriend or your husband or a man that you can't trust. It's life itself you can't trust. You don't trust, period. You could lie in a dark room by yourself, nobody around, and you'll just be laying on your back. And maybe you'll have like moments that feel good, but just count the hours. Eventually, you're going to start to panic. Eventually, you're going to start to lose your cool, and you're going to realize that you don't trust this process that is called life. And it's that fundamental existential sense of trust that these practices are trying to expose us to and reveal to us. So as men, if I had a 13-year-old son, I wouldn't rush him. I wouldn't force him to do anything he wouldn't want to do, first of all. I would demonstrate to him what I believe is the most valuable thing a man can know and embody and transmit to those he loves. And I would just transmit it to him. I wouldn't need to prove anything. I wouldn't need him to do anything. And hopefully, as a living demonstration of those qualities, just impress upon his nervous system what that is. To truly live where you feel liberated, even in some sense, that your love is liberated, that your attention is not constantly obsessed on yourself and your own failures or achievements, but actually free to feel outwards and care about others and give yourself freely and communicate from a place where you recognize this experience of life is fucking divine. This is profound that we arise in this condition. Fucking profound. Why waste our short time here fearing it and not trusting it? We're obviously here. And it's that trust that once a man begins to viscerally experience in his body, he sits in front of the person he loves. And just because he knows that, he's the greatest man this woman has ever sat in front of, because he's free. And that's what makes a man recognize his own greatness, which already lives inside of him, is the moment he recognizes he is free. When he trusts, and then that trust radiates out from him. And then when his woman feels like she can't trust, he just looks at her. He doesn't even have to say a word. He takes a breath. He holds her. He embraces her fears, her anger, her sadness, showing her that none of this is going to push me away. I'm here with you. I'm going nowhere. I've got you. That. Every man has the capacity to develop that skill and learn that, but he must become a full, mature adult. And when he does, he knows himself as an actualized man. He's already a man. But is he actualized in his fullness? This is the direction this practice will take us. And that is why there is only one masculine practice. There's only one. Rest is consciousness. Know yourself as that which is already free. All the practices that we do in masculine work is just, if you already knew that, this is how you would sit. This is how you would stand. This is how you would breathe. This is how you would act. So we take the sitting, the standing, the breathing, the actions to try and help us feel what it would be like if we knew that. But in fact, if we just knew ourselves as consciousness, we would already sit like that, stand like that, breathe like that. And we would also be expressing ourselves uniquely in our own unique biologies and personalities. It becomes a beautiful expression of art.
Great answer. How much importance do you put on purpose for a man? And for those men that don't have one, how would they go about discovering it?
Yeah. Well, I want to start at the end of the conversation and then work our way back. So the answer I'm going to give right now probably isn't for everybody, because everyone's in different stages of this process. But I'll say this. When we sit with this inquiry that we're in right now, like, what does a man really want? Like, whether it's tons of money, tons of options and women, the ability to travel all over the world whenever he wants, the ability to go away and not have to do anything, you know, as much free time as he wants, whatever it is, when we really examine what he's yearning for deeply, it's freedom. There's a freedom inside of every man that he yearns for. Almost every war that's ever been fought has been over freedom. So this urge for to experience a kind of freedom is fundamental to a man's existence. And when he finds out he can't achieve it karmically in terms of like money and writing books and going on tours, whatever, he'll like go to a monastery and then he's like, okay, let me try and get free there. But nevertheless, his search for freedom continues. Now, when we understand this at the fundamental root, we start to see that purpose is the object man places between himself and absolute freedom. Because man feels, I need to be free. What do I need to do to become free? Whatever feels most true is his purpose. I need to write a book about this. Okay, let me go do that. And he's like wanting that experience of freedom on the other side, where he could feel like he's given his gift and his life had meaning and purpose, right? So purpose is that which man places between himself and absolute freedom. Here's the thing. If we really deeply study these practices, what we wake up to is there is no object between us and absolute freedom. Your very idea that there is something between you and absolute freedom is delusion. And we're all trying to cure ourselves of that delusion. So there's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go, because your freedom will not be found on the other side of those millions of dollars or that business or that project. In fact, most of the men who come to me are incredibly successful men. And what they always experience and what I reflect back to them is this thing they called their purpose was like a vehicle for them to fly out into, you know, absolute freedom. This purpose was supposed to be a vehicle to absolute freedom, but what it ended up becoming as they're out there floating in space in their quote unquote freedom, they recognize, man, this purpose has actually become my prison. The very thing they built to try and make themselves free 10, 20 years later becomes their prison that they cannot escape. That's a wake-up call. Now, men need to experience that at a profound level before they can really hear the next level of teaching. Most men who haven't even achieved much or really been able to manifest what they want, they still need to go through that process most of the time. They need to really experience that no matter what goal they put in front of them, they're going to achieve it. And in some way, they will not feel any freer. Life could be a little more pleasant, like now you have enough money to go to a restaurant when you want to. That's nice. But at a fundamental level, you don't feel any freer. In fact, you may feel a little bit more trapped. Like, what now? What next? Where do I go? So when we understand purpose as that which is standing between us and absolute freedom, suddenly purpose takes on a different perspective. We begin working with the problem at the root level from a much more spiritually informed way. Here's what starts to happen in that inquiry. So I'll just share it like this. As we sit with that, you feel the irritation that you got to do something. Where does that irritation come from? It comes from the fear that you're not enough, that you're not doing enough, that you need to prove something to be worthy of this life, of love, of appreciation. So fear is the origin. So I feel like I need to do more. So I sit with that and observe it. And as you observe that more and more and more, what happens next? If you're able to feel beyond the fear or just observe it at any clear distance, you start to recognize that just you sitting there observing this state that you're in, suddenly something becomes intensely purposeful about that. And this is what men feel when they do this kind of work. They show up to a workshop, they go to meditation, they have an awakening, and that experience feels like the most purposeful thing they did. And that's why they want to teach it, because there's so much purpose in leaning into that, that suddenly it's so purposeful. And it could sound crazy to like most people, but for people who've experienced this, to just sit in Vipassana for 10, 20, 30 days uninterrupted can be the most purposeful thing in anybody's life. I mean, it's a profoundly purposeful experience. And what are you doing? If you're practicing well, nothing. So it's paradoxical, because when you stop letting fear drive your actions and you start recognizing what's already available to you now, every moment suddenly becomes profoundly purposeful. Suddenly, when you sit in a moment, you sit deeper. You sit with a straighter spine. You breathe deeper, because you're meeting every moment as the most purposeful experience there could possibly be. What's more purposeful than this present moment? So you get to decide, is this moment purposeful or is it not? And if this moment does not feel purposeful to you, your body's going to take a certain shape. You're going to breathe shallow. You're going to feel anxious, you're going to feel afraid, and you're going to start writing out all these blueprints and plans of what you got to do to make that feeling go away. Or you can wake up to the present moment, and this moment now becomes profoundly purposeful, because it is. And unfortunately, it takes like losing a loved one or a near-death experience for us to really taste that, because we'll have that event and then we'll go, wow, life is precious, relationships are precious, this moment is so precious, I thought I had more time, whatever. Like, death reminds us quickly of what I'm describing, but we don't need tragedy to wake up to that very profound experience where it becomes your lived reality. Every moment of your life is profoundly purposeful, just based on the way that you interact with this moment. And what is this moment? It is just consciousness interacting with light. So you can make love to this moment or not. You can trust this moment or not. Those are our options at every critical moment. Now, those are the options we have. That's what this practice is here to teach us.
What's an uncomfortable truth about you?
I would say an uncomfortable truth about me is a large part of why I got into this work and these practices. Was many years of using substances, many years, probably a solid 16-year run, where there wasn't a month that wouldn't go by that I wasn't using some form of intense psychedelic or other form of substance. So I really, and when I would use these, I would use them by myself, and I would use them like in a meditative way, but I would use them to try and really see what were the edges of consciousness. Like, how far could I push myself to where the brain begins to like break down, reality begins to break down? Like, what actually remains? What remains? How far can this experience go when you just, there's no more body, you know? The thing is, today, like, I did that back when drugs were still called drugs. Now they're called medicine. But during my explorations in that, they were called drugs. And I still think of them as drugs. They are drugs. But I got to a point where I could see that was actually destructive on my body and my system. It was just too much. It was just too much. And I had to make a choice. And I got the messages basically, you're done with this. You need to let this go. And I let that, I was fortunate enough to be able to let it go in a big way. I know not everyone's wired that way. I have very close relatives who are not wired that way. So I don't really suggest it for anybody, because you play with fire when you start playing in that world at a high level, because addiction is real, dependency is real, and delusion is real as well. Jesus, you know, you think you're figuring it out and get sober, you know, a few days later, no, you didn't figure anything out. Your life might be a little bit more messy than it was when you started. So I bring that up because my substance past certainly had lots of shadows. Certainly was a domain for me that was destructive, even though I did have I did have a good intention with it, but there was also a tendency in me to be self-destructive with it, just as there was, I've had family members drink themselves to death. So that tendency does live in my biology. So it was always playing with fire. So I had to do a lot of work to retroactively go back and really examine in myself what in that is valuable, what in that is real, what in that can I actually transform into a gift into my life today. And if I can't transform it into a gift, then it was just play, or it was just garbage. And I don't know how much my biochemistry has been affected, or my organs have been affected as a result of those many years. I imagine substantially. I still live with kind of echoes of a compromised biology from how much I really explored there. So today, you know, that period of my life ended about 5-6 years ago. I just made a clear decision that that was no longer my path. And maybe, you know, one day down the road, I could reintroduce at some point just one event or another event. But I would say now my relationship with that world is definitely very interesting. And I don't think a lot of people know that about me in terms of my take on that world and my relationship to it. I don't know that many people who know me know just how intensively I spent in that world of substances and allies, and as we call them today, plant medicines and all of that. But my overall take is this: there's no doubt they opened up experiences within me that allowed me to transcend my perceptions of what I thought reality was, and that was incredibly valuable. But where we get in dangerous territories when we start to mistake those highs and those experiences for something more than just a high or an experience. The work that we have to do is we need to alchemize that awakening and then bring it as a gift to our lived experience, that then suddenly we are a better man or a better woman as a consequence of that experience. And suddenly we are able to love our woman or our child better as a result. And if we can't, we need to check ourselves. And that was the work that I needed to do. That was the work I spent years doing. So that those things aren't for everyone, but again, they are invaluable teachers from time to time. They can make a difference, but we must be very careful not to get swept into the delusion of psychedelics to think, mistake that for awakening itself.
I've heard it once described, meditation and spiritual practices like walking up the mountain, and psychedelics, plant medicines, whatever, is like taking a helicopter up And maybe you get a glimpse from the top, but then they kick you out and you actually fall back further than when you started. I've met many, many people that would go to some party and say, oh, I'm taking medicine. It's like, bullshit. Yeah. It's a fucking drug. Yeah. It's like every day of the week, that's a drug. Yeah. But we have a tendency to be able to convince ourselves that we've had this enlightened experience through substance.
Absolutely. And then we become dependent upon that experience to feel enlightenment or feel ecstasy or feel awake. And that's when it becomes that another form of a prison, right? If I'm dependent on feeling that to feel free or feel love or feel enlightened or feel ecstasy in my body, then I've just created a different form of prison. I'm just a prisoner now of this. And that is not what liberation is about.
When was the last time you were out of integrity?
I feel out of integrity all the time. And that could sound kind of wild, because it was wild the first time I heard it. One of my teachers, David Data, said to me when I was at an event. And he brought up the point, he was like, you're always failing, you know? And it's just, if you've never heard someone say that before, you're like, wait a minute, I'm not always failing. You know, I'm succeeding sometimes. But if you really inquire into that, you're like, holy crap, you're right. Like, there is a part of me that feels like it's always failing, always, constantly. And if I haven't integrated that part or like allowed that part to be part of me, it can feel like a frustrated shadow. Do you know what I mean? Like something you feel at times and you don't want to deal with. And then sometimes you stuff it in the closet and then you're not feeling like a failure. But when we really allow it to be part of our lives, I find it to be, it was a tool that allowed me to progress significantly on my path. It was a recognition that I'm always failing. I'm failing right now speaking to you. That is my lived, felt experience. I could be doing this better. I could be doing this better. We fail when we just try and communicate to another person to speak our intentions. Like, we fail every time with our partner when we try and say something, we want to make them feel happy and instead they shut down. We speak and we try and earn someone's trust, but everything we say, we're losing their trust. It's like language is such a limited tool. These body minds are so limited, but inside of us as consciousness, we feel we're unlimited. And that's a frustrating experience, because we intuit what we're capable of. We intuit what life could feel like. We intuit what a relationship could feel like. And we see it like it's there for us. And it's this incredible thing that we could bring into the world. But when we try and we press it through these body minds, it comes out clumsy. It gets spoken in the wrong way. And now suddenly you just hurt that person and you lost this person's trust. And the easiest way to deal with it is just to say, well, fuck it, I don't care, whatever. But there's nothing intelligent about that. Intelligent would be, wow, look at the impact I just had on my partner. Is that the impact I'm actually wanting to have and create in this relationship? What would I need to do differently with my body mind such that my actual intention comes through my movements, my words, even my thoughts, my emotions, that actually begins to live this experience I know is possible? That's the yoga. That's where we begin transforming and alchemizing all of these parts of ourselves. Because in fact, our body minds, between our DNA and growing up around our parents, our body minds are going to most quickly behave like our parents trained us to behave, however that was. So we can have these incredible ideas of like way we want to live, but until we start transforming those patterns in the way life moves through us, we'll always feel like we're failing the present moment, because we are. We are. We are. And that doesn't have to be a downer. The moment we can actually accept that and that everyone's feeling that way, it's like we can get on with life in a different, there's like a humor to that. I mean, it's fucking hilarious to be a creature, a sentient being with this mind that is absolutely free, with a consciousness that is totally free. We intuit what we are capable of. But the moment we try and bring it through our bodies, we find it's just not enough. And even the greatest of the greats, the greatest fighters in the world, the greatest artists in the world. Giacometti was a great sculptor. I don't know if you know who Giacometti is.
Yeah, I do.
Loved his work. But I mean, even as a child, he was like a virtuoso. Like he was skilled in painting. He was skilled in this. He was skilled in that. But he went to sculpture because he felt it was the one art where he couldn't actually express himself the way he wanted to. It frustrated him. It's like he couldn't succeed there. So he became obsessed with trying to make great sculpture. And his whole life, he felt like he was never making great sculpture. But that very feeling of him failing, pushing him. And now his sculptures are known throughout the world. I mean, like his work is, and it's his sculptures that are he's remembered for. But that fascinates me about us, that we can befriend that feeling of failure, like I'm always failing this, and let it actually follow us into creating something great. So when we let ourselves feel, I'm always failing this present moment, what does that do? Does that shut you down? Or does that inspire you to sit up straighter, take a deep breath, look this moment right in the fucking eyes and say, let's go. Let's dance.
You just spoke to something that I think it's in Untethered Soul. Michael Singer speaks about the way to have an open heart is to not close it. Which is somewhat frustrating to read. I was wondering if you had any other more practical, perhaps, suggestions as how to not close down, especially when you're with your partner and something happens.
Well, first of all, he's spot on. I hope I can break it down in a more practical way, but he's spot on. That's absolutely true. So in sexual yoga, you know, when I'm working with men and women, one of the key things I'm training everyone to do is to sit with a straight spine, relax the front surface of your body, take a deep breath into your belly and genitals, relax. So you're opening your body and you're breathing deeply. Now, when you start to close, your heart closes, you're afraid, whatever, your body won't want to do those things. The first thing your body starts to do, it starts to breathe shallow. Then your shoulders start to round forward. Then your solar plexus collapses. Then you start to fidget. You don't want to be still. And then you just start to invert into your own world. You move inward to separate yourself. You contract because you don't want to feel or experience the outside world. That's what happens to us all the time. And all of us are walking around like that. We're walking around like someone's about to punch us in the gut. We're tight. Because even though no one's been, well, someone might physically punch you, but even though most of the time no one's going to physically punch you in the gut, even when you feel someone's going to emotionally punch you or mentally punch you, your body braces, you clench, you contract. You want to try and numb yourself so you don't feel the impact. Because it hurts. So we find these ways to numb ourselves and fortify ourselves so we can feel indestructible. I mean, that's great if you're, you know, a fighter, a warrior. That's very useful. But when you're trying to experience love in your life or have a healthy relationship, that's not going to serve you that much. And it's certainly not going to teach you how to consciously respond to a conflict or a challenging moment with your lover. Remember, most of those fighters, the way they respond when they're emotionally overloaded is they'll swing, they'll hit. Men and women fighters, we always hear stories about abuse, like physical abuse, because they're fighters. That's what their nervous system is doing, how it responds to intensity, right? So what we want to train ourselves to do is, first of all, just sit up. Take a deep breath, relax the front surface of your body. And then we practice there. So we start to work with emotional and sexual energy. And your job is to keep your body open. Now, for most men, if you start watching porn or masturbating, what you'll notice is as you get closer and closer to climax, your shoulders start to round forward, your solar plexus collapse, your breath gets faster until you pop. It's like you curl in and pop. That's the pattern. Here, you're learning how to keep your body open and relax the entire time. And that's how we learn how to keep our hearts open. So at first, it's going to feel like you're forcing your nervous system to open when it wants to close. That's natural. But after a certain point, you develop a capacity to keep your spine straight, your breath deep, to maintain eye contact when the moment feels very uncomfortable. And you're able to keep your heart soft. Not that you're like in a battle, like you're not doing not staring down Mike Tyson about to go 12 rounds. Like, you're soft. Your belly is soft. If he were to punch you, it would hurt like hell because your body is so undefended. But think about when we talked about trust. To be so free and trust that deeply that you could show up in that moment like that is incredible. It's a profound demonstration. Mike Tyson often talks about how afraid he was as a human being and also in all those fights. Fear drew that mechanism to create such killing force. Here in spiritual practice, we're trying to do the exact opposite, but it takes an equivalent degree of warriorship. You have to be a savage to be able to trust this moment that deeply. You know, back on the Rage Against the Machine CD cover, there was a Thich Quang Duc. Do you know this Vietnamese Mahayana Buddhist monk?
Oh, yeah.
It was self-immolation, where he just set himself on fire. That man, that monk, is truly a hero to me, is a spiritual icon to me. If you're faint of heart, don't go watch this video. But if you want to see something absolutely profound, you can pull up the video of Thich Quang Duc and the self-immolation and watch the whole thing on video. They caught it on video. And what you see there is a man sitting in perfect posture. And even as he sits there surrounded by hundreds monks and nuns who love this man dearly. I mean, he loves them dearly, and he loves them so much he's willing to let his body be a sacrifice, a living sacrifice, to try and create change in their world for them because their voices were being suppressed and they were being killed. So he lays his body and he sits in perfect posture. And he even wrote a letter before this event talking about what he would do as he sat there. And he said he would see the face of the Buddha and concentrate on the face of the Buddha. And he sat there and you watch his body just engulf in flames. You can't even imagine the horrific sensation, the intensity of feeling what that must be like. And he sat there perfectly still, not a sound. And you can feel his love just emanate through this total body sacrifice. He trusted so deeply. His love was so certain, so uncompromised. Even the intensity of the heat couldn't turn him back. It didn't make him get up and scream and run around. And other people have tried this, and that's what they do. This man sat impeccably, perfectly present. His heart remained open the whole time. And after a few minutes, when there was no more life in his body just fell to the side. And still, they have his heart preserved. They preserved his heart, and you can actually go see it. It's a symbol. But when we talk about what does it mean to be a great man? What does it mean to know ourselves? Where we could love and trust at that level, and then our bodies become a living sacrifice of that expression, of that truth, of that certainty. All of us as men, we have something in our biology that tells us our body should be sacrificed for something great. This is what allows men to go into war. Because if they're fighting for a cause they believe in, they say, take my flesh. If they believe in it, take my flesh. And there's a high honor to that. There's something incredibly beautiful about that. No, I'm not for violence. And I'm not for self-immolation either. I'm not saying burning yourself is the way to go. I wouldn't choose that path. But what I am saying is, when we can know ourselves and be so certain and love and trust at that level that our body mind becomes the sacrifice for that which we know. How could we live at a mean? We are, our presence on this planet suddenly becomes something that creates a lasting impression that people never forget. When people look to us, they see hope because they see something that could trust, because what they saw in us was someone capable of trusting. Someone capable of loving, even in the darkest hour. Those are the people we remember. How do we become that man? Do we want to become that man? And that becomes our invitation, our inquiry. So whenever I'm sitting in meditation or in a conflict with my partner or trying to get on my daughter's shoes, I think of Thich Quang Duc. And if I can't sit present in this moment, what's my practice? If I can't be with the intensity of this, what kind of practitioner am I? Nonsense. And that impression lives in me, lives with me, and informs my practice, and it makes every moment here, just with you now, absolutely precious. Absolutely precious.
Powerful. What's your deepest fear?
Be honest with you, what I just described has come up in my mind as the deepest fear several times. I've been in meditation and suddenly, spontaneously, I found myself in that moment engulfed in flames. And I could experience tacitly what that may be like. And somehow my nervous system, I was able to feel at such a deep level, and the degree of fear in those final moments where the body mind dissolves completely, is annihilated completely, is totally lost, totally burned up, totally sacrificed, totally dissolved. How could that not be anyone's greatest fear? The absolute annihilation of self, the absolute annihilation of self, the complete letting go. So sitting with death as an activity, not as something that's going to happen in the future, but as an activity that's happening now, that this body mind is dying now, is dissolving now, everything around me is dissolving now. All of this, we are all dissolving together in this. We're all dissolving through this process, this imminent death. How do I love? How do I love through that? How do I love this imminent death? And once we even start that inquiry, how could we not possibly become more compassionate people? More patient people, more understanding people? Why you gotta win every fight? Why you gotta start fights? Why I gotta prove you this, that, the other thing. Fucking nonsense. When we start recognizing and waking up to this event that we are all participating in, and all of us are scared as fuck, absolutely terrified. And we all express that fear in different ways. And we think it's about the email that got sent, or the text message, or this that happened, or that happened to you. It's about none of that. It's that you're fucking afraid to be alive, and you don't know why you're here. And you're struggling to reconcile that. You're trying to find meaning in it all, but you can't, because here death looms staring in the face. And it feels it's been made to be such an evil demon, a dark creature that we can't trust. If we can't trust death, you can't trust life, period. If you can't trust death, you can't trust life, period. If you can't trust, you will live in fear perpetually. Every action, every thought, every emotion will be based in fear. Loving death, loving this condition in which we arise, loving that we are all here being sacrificed. We have no choice about it. The body and mind will become dust, ash again. We have no choice in that matter. So we might as well learn to love this process. And it's through that love, it's through that love that we are liberated, only through that love. There's no spaceship that's going to take us to liberation. We must love what is. We must love this process. We must find love and keep the heart from closing as the body dissolves. And there, our purpose naturally shines through. Effortless.
What would you love for men to know with every fiber of their being?
That you can absolutely create the relationships in your life that you want to have. That through these practices and this path, you become a co-creator of every relationship in your life rather than a bystander or a passenger or even a victim of these relationships. I see a lot of men suffer in intimate relationship, and I work with a lot of men who suffer in intimate relationship. And what I teach them is step by step, how to become a co-creator of the relationship they have, how to become a leader in the relationship they have, how to become an inspiration that inspires love and trust, that creates love and trust. We don't merely ask to be loved or ask to be trusted. That's nonsense. It's not how those things are earned. You can't talk someone into trusting you or loving you. Maybe you can on a superficial level in business, but I mean in a deep level where it's your intimate partner, you cannot talk them into trusting you or loving you. They either do or they don't. So when you start to take full responsibility and inspire the person you love into that level of trust, into that degree of certainty, that just to live by your side in this world allows them to trust life a little deeper. Your partner starts to surrender in a way that is ecstatic and profound. You make love to that, in that surrendered state, and love making becomes sacred. It becomes divine. It becomes something that cannot be pretended or acted or paid for or negotiated. It can't be. Because you begin to unlock an experience in your partner where they can really surrender to your lead. And once you make love in that state, you begin to recognize what deep love has always been about. And when you have that, conflicts still come up, but they are nothing. They are nothing compared to the love and trust that you have between you and your partner, because you are the bringer of love and trust. You're no longer waiting to be loved and trusted. You are the bringer of those qualities. You are the bringer of love and trust. When you're empowered in that way, your relationships, every relationship in your life transforms dramatically. You step into adulthood as a fully conscious and loving human being.
What's your daily practice?
Wake up early, do about an hour sit, typically Vipassana, sometimes a little bit of breath work. I work with internal channels, central channels, down from crown to root, because it's very useful for sexual yoga. So I breathe up and down those channels. I open those internal channels in my body mind. And then my partner walks into the room after an hour of meditation. So a bell goes off, my partner comes in and sits down in front of me. And then we do 40 minutes of sexual yoga practice, where over the years we've taken the bits we've learned and studied from all different teachers, and we've created our own practices fundamentally. That basically we sit together and meditate each other's bodies. We clear the debris of whatever came up in our relationship. It's a way to process whatever ugly emotions are there with your partner without going into therapy, without talking about it. And it's beautiful because, you know, therapy is important. I'm not dissing therapy. It's a useful tool, but no one feels like fucking on the drive home from therapy. Why is that? Because we're analyzing the situation. We're trying to come together as equals. When you learn to actually bring what you feel, what you see, to your partner in a way that's not therapeutic, you can actually preserve polarity and maintain sexual connection as you heal whatever wounds or conflicts came up around you. And that's what our practice does. So we sit down and the first thing is we say, you know, I see, I feel, and just report to each other. I see, I feel. One partner's the seer, one partner's the feeler. So whenever you're the seer, you're an alpha. Whenever you're the feeler, you're an omega, right? That's how therapy works. You sit on the couch and you say, I feel. And then the therapist goes, I see, I see. It's an alpha omega relationship. That's why it's healing. But you can do that with your partner and I see, I feel without analyzing anything that's there. Just say what you see and feel in real time, like you're doing Vipassana between two bodies. And then after about 10, 20 minutes there, what we find is our desire to touch and love each other naturally arises. There's no forced polarity there. There's nothing. It's like suddenly in the first 30 seconds, I could say, I see how hard you're working. I see a tired and weary heart. I see sadness in your eyes. And then a couple minutes go by and then suddenly I see how much you mean to me. I see the woman that I love. I see lips I want to kiss. I see thighs I want to touch. And it begins to just, what you see and feel starts to, like, you liberate your sexuality just in that, right? You come out of your stuck emotions and you start to see and feel, oh, I actually love this person. I do want to touch them. And then from there, we move into practices where we actually engage intimately. So we'll have lovemaking almost every single morning when we do this practice. So it's an hour of solo practice, 40 minutes of partner practice. We bow when the bell goes off, and then we wake up our daughter, who's a maniac, and then we're just back in mom and dad mode. And that could be the only amount of polarity we have for the whole day. And that's cool because we have a place for it to thrive. We foster our passionate connection. And the rest of the day is this stuff.
Last question. If you could carry one memory from this life into your next life, what would that be? Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be a memory in the form of a visual, or even an event that took place. It'd be a memory in the form of knowing. It would be a remembering. It'd be remembering that you already are free. You already are love. There's nothing more precious that I've uncovered in this world, in this lifetime, than that. And to know that for countless lifetimes, to never forget that for countless lifetimes. What greater? What greater knowing could we bring with us?
So what have you got on offer that guys, women, couples can look you up and seek you out?
The best place to go is my website, justinpatrickpierce.com. And on there, there'll be links for in-person workshops. We'll be hosting at least 4 of them in Florida this year coming up. I actually just announced another one in February 11th and 12th. So that we haven't even announced yet, but they sell out incredibly quick. So if you're serious about finding out about them, definitely get on my mailing list. Definitely check out my website. We're going to try and release a few events, so we have plenty of room for people to join us. The in-person workshops is where you're really going to get the partner practice. So whether you're single, whether you're a couple, you can come and practice with other partners and dive deep into the yoga of intimacy. I also do private mentorships. So we'd meet one-on-one like this. I work with couples, work with women, I work with men in a one-on-one capacity. And then I would say the last opportunity is my wife and I offer monthly group calls. So we have a men's group, we have a women's group, and we have a practice evening for couples. So if you're in a couple and you want to be guided through practices, we also offer that. And all of our online classes, group calls, are on patreon.com/yogaofintimacy.
Right, that was genuinely one of the most beautiful and inspiring podcasts I've hosted. So thank you deeply for your answers and your honesty and your presence and all of it. It's been a real honor.
It's an honor, Nick. I just love making this connection with you. I hope we can stay connected, and I'm excited to grow with you.
Yeah, it's gonna happen for sure. Thank you, mate.